Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the crimes of Ted Bundy. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for The Deathcast or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to tell your friends about the show. Secondly, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. And as always, I have to give a shout out to my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. You guys rock. All right, now that all that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we were in the beginning of January 1974, and Ted Bundy had just exacted his revenge against his ex-girlfriend, Diane Edwards, by making her fall in love with him, think that she was his fiancé, only to tell her extremely coldly that he had no idea what she was talking about when Diane contacted him on January 2nd, 1974. Now, this is a pivotal moment in Ted Bundy's life. This enacting of revenge, which obviously he has been fantasizing about since Diane broke up with him, and the other fantasies that Bundy has been having. After this event, Bundy goes on to commit what became known in Washington and Seattle as the Ted Murders, and he begins very quickly. There is no waiting period in between breaking up with Diane Edwards and Bundy going on the prowl. On January 4th, 1974, a then unidentified individual entered the basement bedroom of an 18-year-old dancer and college student named Karen Sparks. Now, while there were other roommates in the house that Karen lived in, she had the basement largely to herself, and this basement bedroom was accessed through the main house upstairs, but also through a side door which led outside, and the roommates all stated that this side door was notoriously difficult to open, so none of them ever used it, and it was always kept locked. Now, her roommates noticed that Karen was missing the following morning, thinking that she was sleeping in. They went about their day. However, that by that afternoon, when Karen still had not appeared, they became concerned and went down to the bedroom where they knocked and called for her. Getting no response from Karen, the roommates entered the room and approached her bed, only to recoil in horror upon discovering Karen lying in bed, her face and hair matted with blood. Now, obviously, they very quickly contacted police, who arrived and surveyed the scene. There was no evidence at the scene that they could discern. However, they did note that the object used to assault Karen was part of the bed frame, was a piece of metal that had been pulled off, and after being used to bludgeon her, was forced inside of her vaginal cavity. Amazingly, Karen was alive, although she was unconscious for an extended period of time, and ended up suffering some pretty horrific brain damage, not being able to recall events leading up to the attack itself, or anything that occurred thereafter. Because of this, the case very quickly goes cold. Now, as for the perpetrator, who would later identify himself as Ted Bundy, it seems that the key thing he took away from this attack was not to leave the victim behind. Bundy's next victim was a 21-year-old college student by the name of Linda Ann Healy. And Healy was a local, having grown up in the Newport Hills section of Seattle. It's been said that Linda lived a very sheltered upbringing in this middle-class neighborhood. And upon entering college at the University of Washington, she decided to major in psychology. In addition to this, she worked for a local radio station giving the morning ski report. She lived in a large house with four other female roommates, who all said that Linda, while fun, was a fairly straight-laced young woman. Her movements on the date in question, January 31st, were fairly routine for her. At some time between 5:30 and 6 a.m., Linda had gone to the radio station and recorded that morning ski report before going to classes and then returning to the house where she wrote a letter, which reads, "Just thought I'd drop a line to say hello. It's snowing outside, so I'm writing this letter huddled in my blue afghan. You wouldn't believe how comfortable it makes studying or napping. Everyone at my house is fine. I've invited Mom and Dad, Bob and Laura, to dinner. I think I'll make beef stroganoff. I've been doing a lot of skiing, some working and studying, not necessarily in that order." Now, Linda's parents were scheduled to come to the house the following day, February 1st. Back to January 31st, at roughly 2:30, one of Linda's roommates drove Linda, who did not possess a car of her own, to chorus practice before picking her back up at 5 p.m. Linda and two of her roommates had dinner before Linda borrowed one of her roommates' cars and drove to a nearby grocery store to pick up supplies for the dinner that she was planning for her family, returning at roughly 8:30 p.m. Afterwards, Linda, two of her roommates, and a male friend walked to a nearby bar where they shared two pitchers of beer before returning back to the house. Upon returning to the home, a former boyfriend of Linda's who lived in Olympia, Washington, and her roommates guesstimated that Linda spoke to this man for about an hour, after which the roommates watched television together before going to bed. Linda had a room in the basement, as did another one of her roommates. These rooms were separated by a thin plywood wall. On the morning of February 1st, the roommate heard Linda's alarm clock going off at 5:30. The roommate goes back to sleep and is awoken at 6 a.m. by her own alarm. Upon getting up, the roommate continues to hear Linda's alarm blaring, which was to her was odd, as Linda was very fastidious about getting up and getting going in the morning. Not long after this roommate gets up, the house and the phone rings, and it's Linda's employer at the radio station looking for her, as she is due to be at the radio station already to record that morning's ski report. So Linda's roommate goes down into the bedroom, only to find it empty and that the bed is made. She relays this information to Linda's employer before going about her own day, under the assumption that Linda Ann Healy was already on her way to the radio station to record. Now, at some point during the morning, one of the roommates made a discovery that kind of upset all of those who lived in the house, and that is that the side door which led into the basement was unlocked. Now, the reason this was unusual is because, as at the Karen Sparks residence, the side door that led into this basement was extremely difficult to relock. Now, someone had lost the key to the door, and anyone who used it would have to exit through it to bring whatever it was that they had to bring outside, and then go back around into the house and lock it from the interior. And this led the roommates to shun using this door. This was noted amongst the roommates that morning, although it appears that most of them had classes or jobs to get to, and nothing much was said of it after the initial conversation that this door is unlocked and that's not normal. That afternoon, the other roommates encountered one another at the campus and discussed the fact that Linda had not been seen that morning, in fact, had not been seen all day, which was unusual. When Linda's family arrives that evening and there is still no sign of a Linda, the roommates are truly alarmed and they contact the local police department to let them know that something is wrong. The two officers from the homicide unit arrived at the house to take statements before investigating Linda's bedroom. They discovered a number of things. First and foremost was the fact that Linda's bed was made in a manner different from the way it usually was, with the blankets pulled up over the pillow. Upon removing the blankets from the bed, a blood stain was found on the pillow, as well as in the center of the bed, having soaked through the sheets and into the mattress beneath. Further investigation revealed that a few articles of clothing were missing from Linda's closet. But more importantly, the nightgown Linda had been wearing when she went to bed was found hanging in the closet with blood dried all along the collar. Obviously, this created an air of hysteria within the house. But sadly, there was no trace of Linda Ann Healy, and they would not find any trace of her for a very long time. The roommates were well aware of the attack that had occurred on Karen Sparks blocks away only a few weeks beforehand, and the disappearance of their roommate led all of the remaining girls to quickly abandon the house and to seek homes elsewhere. Now, news of this disappearance made its rounds throughout Seattle, and talk among law enforcement was there was the distinct possibility that these two incidents were very probably linked to one another. On February 4th, a male caller contacted the Seattle Police Department through the emergency services number, stating, quote, "Listen and listen carefully. The person who attacked that girl on 8th last month and then the person who took Linda Ann Healy away are one and the same. He was outside both houses. He was seen." The operator then asks, "Who is calling?" And the caller responds, "No way are you going to get my name," before hanging up. Now, it has never been conclusively proven whether or not it was Ted Bundy making these calls, although some have speculated that it was, in fact, Bundy. There is also a theory going around out there, and has been for many years, that Ted Bundy may have had an accomplice in some of these murders, and that the individual who made this particular call was, in fact, that accomplice. Although the majority of people familiar with this case do not believe this to be true, it should be pointed out that this theory is out there. And those who promote this theory most often cite the fact that Bundy is known to have killed over 30 women, escaped from 2 jails successfully, but was also able to carry out the majority of his crimes seemingly in broad daylight with no one taking any real notice of things being amiss. As with most cases of this nature, the detectives went above and beyond in their attempts to solve Linda Ann Healy's disappearance, talking to all of her roommates, acquaintances, as well as her current and former boyfriends, all to no avail. And as with Karen Sparks' case, eventually Linda Ann Healy's disappearance goes cold. On March 19th, 1974, a 19-year-old woman named Donna Gail Mason, who attended Evergreen State College, disappeared. And here Bundy changes his MO slightly. Both Karen Sparks and Linda Ann Healy had been tall brunettes that parted their hair in the middle. Donna Mason was on the shorter side, standing roughly 5 foot tall. It's known by her roommates that Donna had planned to attend a jazz concert on campus that evening and had gone through several different changes of clothing before heading out on foot at roughly 7 p.m. This is going to hinder detectives somewhat because Donna was changing her clothing so much. It was difficult for her roommates to recall precisely what it was that she was wearing when she left. Donna was quite a bit different from Bundy's first two victims in that she lived a rather carefree, transient lifestyle, and it was not unusual for her to disappear for a few days at a time before showing back up with tales of her latest adventure. However, when no one had heard from Donna after 6 days, her friends and relatives became concerned. It's known that at least one friend contacted the police asking them to do a welfare check, which quickly turned into a full-scale investigation looking for her. As with the other two girls, no sign of Donna could be located. One interesting twist in Donna's case is that she was into things like witchcraft and alchemy, and when police first became involved and began looking at the case, they thought that Donna may have committed suicide. This is because a lot of her writings had to do with death. However, after a psychologist went over Donna's writings, suicide was ruled out as it was not believed her writings concerned any form of self-harm, but were rather in line with her personal set of beliefs and her interest in these topics. One thing we should touch on briefly before we move into these next spate of disappearances is that in her book, The Stranger Beside Me, true crime author and former police officer Anne Rule tries to draw a connection between the Ted murders and the disappearance of a teenager by the name of Kathy Devine, whose body was eventually found prior to Kathy Sparks going missing. The reason I bring this up is that some sites list Devine as either an absolute victim of Bundy or a very possible victim of Bundy. However, Bundy himself never took credit for this particular crime, and officers involved in the case did not believe that this particular homicide bore any of the hallmarks of a Bundy murder. And in fact, for those who are into this type of thing, Devine's murder was eventually solved in 2002 when DNA matched a convicted rapist by the name of William E. Cosden Jr. to Kathy Devine's murder. After the disappearance of Donna Mason, Bundy goes through a cooling off period, as he often does during this point in his serial killings, striking again on April 17th, this time at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg. A freshman at the college by the names of Susan Elaine Rancourt, aged 18, went missing. Now, Susan was described as blonde, tall, with piercing blue eyes, and an extremely high IQ. And again, we see a shift in Bundy's modus operandi, as now he is targeting a woman with blonde hair, whereas before it had been brunettes. What we know about Susan is that she was one of six children whose family had moved from Washington to Alaska. Susan had stayed behind to attend college, and that during her freshman year, she was majoring in biology and working full-time at a local nursing home. It was said that Susan was deathly afraid of the dark and never went anywhere after sunset without one of her roommates or a close, trusted friend. She was extremely nearsighted and was known to wear both glasses and contact lenses, and all of this makes Susan's disappearance very disturbing, in that on the night of April 17th, Susan left her dorm by herself without wearing her glasses. At roughly 8 p.m., first she went to one of the dorms on campus where she put laundry in and headed off for an advisor's meeting. After this meeting, Susan had plans to meet with a friend, go see a film on campus, and then return to the laundry where she was going to put her clothing in the dryer. However, after leaving the advisor's meeting, Susan was not seen again. When Susan Rancourt does not return to her dormitory, it is immediately reported. Campus police attempted to retrace Susan's steps that evening, and they noted that the most common route that anyone would take took the individual walking it underneath a trestle, which at that time of night would be very dark. And it was surmised that this is more likely than not where Susan had met whoever it was that had taken her. Now, Susan's disappearance was different in that women began coming forward to campus and local police talking about a tall, dark, mysterious stranger that they had encountered on campus in the days leading up to Susan's disappearance. He was described as roughly 6 foot, well-kept, with one arm in a sling and a metal brace upon his finger. One woman who came forward stated that the man was having trouble managing his books and kept dropping them, and eventually asked her if she would help him carry the books to his car, which was parked nearby. The girl noted that the vehicle, a Volkswagen Bug, was parked very close to the train trestle. She agreed to help him, and upon reaching the Bug, noticed that the passenger side seat had been removed. The young woman stated that upon seeing this, she had a sudden sense of dread and placed the books on the man's car before hurrying away. Another student came forward stating that on the 17th, she too had met the man with his arm in a sling and a brace on his finger, who had been attempting to carry some packages. This woman stated that the man approached her and said he was having a difficult time carrying these packages to his car. And she agreed to help him carry the packages to the car, again a Volkswagen Beetle. And upon reaching the car, the man stated that he was having trouble getting it started and was wondering if she would be able to help him get it running. This woman, too, stated to the police that she felt something was off about the entire situation and, quote, "I didn't want to get in his car and I just made some excuse about being in a hurry and left." Others had seen this same individual on campus during the day. Most put his age as being in his mid to late 20s. These stories are ones that are going to continue to come up again and again over the course of the crimes in Washington, Seattle, and Utah. A man with his arm in a sling, driving a Volkswagen Bug, having problems carrying things. Sometimes the arm is not in a sling, he is instead in a leg cast, but it always remains the same. He needs help either getting something to his car, getting the car started, or getting something off campus into his car. Unfortunately, we will never know the exact amount of women that Bundy approached with this ruse. We only know of those who fell for it and were never seen again. Now, Bundy was a very cunning predator, and that is exactly what he was. Many serial killers act on the spur of the moment. Bundy did not. He struck when he felt that the mood and the opportunity were right. And during the early part of his murderous career, he was very, very careful to avoid any sort of detection. Although, as we're going to see in future episodes, his cautious nature eventually begins to give way as Bundy begins to spiral out of control. His next known victim was not taken from Washington, but in fact disappeared in Oregon on May 6th. That was the day that Roberta Kathleen Parks, age 22, vanished from life forever. Now, Kathy had a tumultuous few days. She'd broken up with her boyfriend, who had gone to college in Louisiana, had an argument with her father on the 4th, and then learned on the 6th that her father had suffered a massive heart attack. And Kathy, it was thought, may have blamed herself for her father's heart attack. Although it should be noted that her family did, in fact, let Kathy know that her father's heart attack was not her doing. After participating in a group exercise session at the dorm building that Kathy lived at, she told her roommate she was going to get coffee with some friends over at the student union and promised to be back within the hour. Kathy was never seen again. She too was thought to be a possible suicide. However, this was eventually ruled out. Unlike Susan Rancourt, no one saw anything in regards to Kathy and her abductor. And police in Washington and Oregon very quickly realized that there was an extremely good chance that all of these missing young co-eds were connected to one another. And as a result of this, the police distributed flyers with pictures of all four missing girls up and down the West Coast. Now, something like this might be rather commonplace in today's day and age, where police procedures and communications between different departments and various states is much more open. In 1974, this was unheard of. So the fact that police departments from two separate states were working together so quickly after linking all of these disappearances together should give you some idea as to how serious they were taking these disappearances. If it had been even 3 or 4 years earlier, there is a very good chance that the detectives from these various precincts would have written the majority of these young girls off as runaways, victims of the counterculture movement going on in America. Given as the hippie movement had died an inglorious death, however, and the nature of the majority of these missing girls, they quickly realized that there was a problem going on and that they needed to solve it as soon as possible. But not only because there were more women likely to go missing, but also because this type of activity tends to cause panics among the population, and they wanted to avoid that at all costs. However, unfortunately, that is not going to happen. And the Ted murders, as they're going to end up being known as by the end of 1975, are going to wind up being known across the entirety of the country before the man responsible for them is eventually identified. As for his personal life, Bundy continued to act as though nothing was amiss. He continued with his various political dealings and his relationship with his long-term girlfriend, who noted years later that during the time each one of these women disappeared, Bundy was unaccounted for. However, as she would later state, Bundy was always rather aloof with what it was he was doing when he was not in her presence, and she didn't think anything of it. Even when the first name Ted is linked to a number of these disappearances. On June 1st, a 22-year-old former college student, Brenda Carol Ball, ends up disappearing from Seattle. It's known that on the evening of May 31st, June 1st, Brenda had gone to the Flame Tavern. Her roommates later confirmed that they had seen Brenda that afternoon at roughly 2 p.m., where she told them she planned on going to the tavern, having a few drinks, before catching a ride to the Sun Lakes State Park, where she planned to meet up with her roommates and spend the remainder of the evening. Brenda is known to have stayed at the tavern until roughly 2 a.m., at which point she began asking if she could get a ride. No one was either willing or able to give her a ride, and Brenda was last seen talking to a man in the parking lot who had his arm in a sling. Much like Donna Mason, Brenda was known to be a free spirit who would go off on some form of adventure before turning up to regale her friends, roommates, and family with stories of her latest odyssey. It was 19 days before Brenda's roommates decided that something was most definitely wrong and decided to start looking around. They checked with her bank and learned that there had been no activity in Brenda's account, nor had her family seen her. And it was at this point that the roommates contacted the Seattle Police Department. Other than the vague description of a handsome man with his arm in a sling, officers had nothing to go on, and Brenda's case soon joined the previous four as missing, presumed to be endangered. The next young woman to go missing was claimed by Bundy as a victim. However, she is still listed on various databases as being a missing person, as despite the fact that Bundy stated her body was at one of his dump sites, it has never been conclusively proven that Georgianne Hawkins was in fact one of his victims. This particular crime is the first brazen act that Bundy is known to have committed during the course of his crimes. In the 18-year-old Georgianne Hawkins disappears within running distance of her back door along Sorority Row at Washington State University. Now, Georgianne was an 18-year-old freshman, came from a fairly well-to-do family. She was an honor student. Now, on the night of June 10th and 11th, Georgianne had a fairly active evening. She'd gone to a sorority party with one of her sorority sisters, and she had told those at the party that she needed to get back to her fraternity house in order to study for her Spanish final, which was the next day, as Georgianne was fearful that this, of all classes, might hurt her perfect A average. However, she did tell those in attendance that before she returned home, she was going to stop at the fraternity house where her boyfriend lived, which was only six houses away from her own. Now, you need to envision this street. You have sorority houses lining both sides of the street with a strip of greenery separating them both in the middle of the street. Now, behind each set of sorority houses, there is a wide, well-lit sidewalk that is in constant use. There are always students using this sidewalk either to go to classes or different areas on campus or to visit one another in the various fraternities. And it's known that Georgianne was terrified of being out at night on campus, although it is also known that she did not fear walking along this sorority row because there were so many people about and it was so well lit. She felt safe knowing that there was more likely than not someone she knew very close by at all times. Now, it's known that on the early morning hours of June 11th, Georgianne did go to the Betta house where her boyfriend lived at roughly 12:30 a.m., where she stayed for roughly half an hour to 45 minutes. After this, Georgianne walked out the back door and proceeded to head the 90 feet over to where her own fraternity house was located. Somebody had heard her leaving the house and leaned out the window, calling to her, quote, "Hey George, what's happening?" Georgianne stopped and spoke with this man for a brief moment, letting him know that she was on her way back to the sorority house to cram for her Spanish final. Now, two witnesses who knew Georgianne stated that they saw her traverse the next 20 or so feet on her way back to the sorority house. In the sorority house, Georgianne's roommate, who had gone with her earlier that night to the party, sat waiting up, knowing that Georgianne would be throwing pebbles at their window at any moment for her roommate to hear so she could run downstairs and let her in the house. This never happens. Somewhere in the last 40 feet from her boyfriend's sorority house to Georgianne's sorority house, she simply disappears. It's been speculated that Bundy overheard someone saying her name and called out to her, and that because Georgianne was nearsighted, she'd had to go up close to the individual to see who it was that was calling to her. However, this is pure speculation. What we do know is that after being seen by the two men in this little alleyway, Georgianne Hawkins completely disappears, never to be seen or heard from again. Georgianne's roommate does notify the house mother that morning at some point after 1 a.m. that Georgianne had not returned to the house, and they contact the Seattle Police Department that day to report her as missing. Again, as with so many of these cases, there really is no evidence for anyone to go on. Her roommate informed detectives that Georgianne never went any place without giving her a phone number of where she could be found. She also provided a button that had broken off of the clothing that Georgianne was wearing when she was last seen, in the hopes that this might help find her. From Georgianne's disappearance, two witnesses came forward to describe incidents that had occurred near Sorority Row on June 11th. The first, a woman, stated that she had seen a young man walking with a leg cast on using crutches, and that this man had been carrying a briefcase, which she kept dropping. The young woman stated that she had offered to help the man, who claimed he needed help getting back to his car. The woman explained that she could help him with this, however, she needed to stop at one of the nearby sorority houses for a few minutes, after which she would be more than happy to help the man. He agreed to this, however. The woman was inside the house for longer than she had expected, and when she came back out, the man was no longer there. It's important to note that she gave the time of this encounter at roughly 12:30 a.m. The other was a male college student who was out with his girlfriend who saw a young man walking with a young woman. She was carrying his briefcase as he hobbled along on crutches, talking to her as they went. Now, this young man returned his girlfriend to her sorority house and later saw the young woman she had seen with the man on the crutches walking alone. And it's at this point that Susan Rancourt's disappearance is fully acknowledged as being part of the pattern that was now emerging in Seattle. Georgianne Hawkins' father spoke to the media shortly after his daughter's disappearance and stated, quote, "Every day, I'm a little bit lower. You like to hope, but I'm too realistic. She was a very friendly, very involved youngster. I keep saying was. I shouldn't say that. It's a job raising kids. You steer them along, and we figured we had both our kids over the hump." With the news that all of these cases were now linked together, stories began circulating throughout the region of people having had encounters with this mysterious individual, either with his leg in a cast or wearing an arm brace. Now, the problem with these stories is that none of them can be verified, and it's highly, highly doubtful that the majority of them are true. But this is the type of mass hysteria that detectives had been worried about causing by publicly linking all of these cases together. Unfortunately, in this type of situation, it is not something that the police really have any control over unless they are able to find and detain a suspect extremely quickly. In the case of Ted Bundy, however, That is not what happened. He continues to go on his killing spree unheeded. And this next batch of missing persons that we are going to discuss are very probably the most famous of the Ted murders that took place within the western part of the United States. And that is because Bundy really steps out from the shadows with these crimes. He is seen not by one or two people, but by thousands of people. And I am, of course, talking about the crimes that took place on July 14th in Lake Sammamish State Park. Now, it's estimated that there are over 40,000 people were in the park throughout the course of that day. And over the course of that day, it was noted that young women who were by themselves were approached by a young man wearing a white t-shirt, jeans, and with one arm in a sling, asking for help loading his sailboat onto his car. Now, many of these women turned this man down. Two of them, unfortunately, did not. One woman who did go with this man later stated that upon going with him, they approached a metallic brown Volkswagen Bug, only for her to discover that the sailboat was not there, and the man stated that his sailboat was actually at his house, which was roughly a mile away. This woman declined to help him further and saw him on his way. The man continued throughout the course of the morning to ask women for their help. This same woman later stated that at roughly 12:30 that day, she saw the man again talking to a woman and thought it odd, but quickly dismissed it as she had her own things going on. Some point during that day, a 23-year-old woman by the name of Janice Ott, who worked for the King County Youth Service Center, was approached by this man and asked to help him load his sailboat on the car. People nearby heard the conversation between this man, who identified himself as Ted, and Janice Ann Ott, and heard her agree to go with him to put the sailboat on his car. Now, why nobody hearing this didn't tell a man that this was going on to go over and offer their help is unknown. It seems very odd to me that people would hear this conversation and not think it odd that a man was asking a woman for help with loading a sailboat when there were thousands of able-bodied men in the park that day who all would have been much better suited physically to help the man. Be that as it may, no one seems to have really taken note of this man in regards to being disturbed by him asking women this question. It's known that Janice did go with Ted Bundy, and then she got into his car ostensibly to go load the sailboat, which he stated was at his house, and was never seen again. Later that same day, this same individual, referring to himself as Ted, was again seen at the park asking women yet again if they would help him load his sailboat onto the car. And again, no one thought that this was odd or stepped in to offer assistance. 19-year-old Denise Marie Nasland was at the park with her boyfriend and two other friends. Now, this particular abduction is a little bit different. At roughly 4 o'clock that afternoon, a 16-year-old girl returned to her friends to tell them that she had been coming back from the bathroom when a man with his arm in a sling had approached her and asked for help launching his sailboat. However, the 16-year-old was not about to go help this strange man who was obviously older with her, and she quickly ran back to her friends and told them about it. At roughly 4:15 p.m., another young woman was approached by this man and asked the same question. She, too, declined. At roughly 4:30, Denise Naslin left her friends to go and use the restroom. The last known sighting of Denise was in the bathroom, where she was seen talking to another woman who she walked out of the restroom with. Denise was never seen again. We do know that after Denise walked off from her group of friends, another woman in the park was approached by this Ted fellow asking for help putting the sailboat onto his car. However, this young woman had seen Bundy staring at her and had felt uncomfortable, so she very wisely chose not to accompany him. Now, a couple of things concerning these crimes. We don't know whether or not Bundy approached this girl before or after he took Denise. If it was before, then that just means that she escaped harm and that at this point Denise was still safe and free. If it was after, it raises some interesting questions. Namely, was Denise already unconscious or dead inside of Bundy's car? And was he feeling the need to kill such that he decided to risk taking one more from the same hunting grounds that he had just stalked? Not once, but twice. But there is also another question that these disappearances and murders raise, and that is simply this. Was Janice Ott already dead when Ted Bundy went and took Denise? I have always believed that Janice Ott was still alive and was being kept somewhere by Bundy when he went back to the park. And my belief is that he'd gone back to the park because he took a perverse joy in seeing his victims terrified. Now, there's no way to know with certainty whether or not this is the case, but I have always felt and suspected that Bundy probably had both of the victims alive at the same time and killed one in front of the other to let the other one know just exactly what fate awaited her. However, that's not the kind of detail Bundy would ever really give. He would more likely than not say that he had killed Janice Ott prior to abducting and murdering Denise. I still believe in my heart, however, that Bundy did in fact kill one in front of the other. I just have always felt that was the case. Now, Denise's friends did not report her as officially missing until 8:30 that evening, at which point the police come out and they begin to question them as well as to seek witnesses. And it's from these witnesses that they learn of this man going by the name of Ted with his arm in a sling approaching females on their own and asking them for help either loading or launching his sailboat. And just like I suspect that Bundy killed one of the two young women in front of the other, I've always felt that the loading of the sailboat was in reference to the woman that Bundy was currently talking to and planned on abducting. And the launching of the sailboat was a reference known only to him of making the other victim watch the other die, which is why I believe that this young woman who was approached by Bundy at being asked to help load his sailboat, this is the one that ran away from him because he was staring at her, I think that she was more likely than not approached after Ted had taken Denise, and that he wanted that young woman to see the other two die. I don't know why I've always felt this way, but it's one of those things that has always stuck with me about this particular day. I really do believe that that is what happened, and that is what Ted was referring to when he said the things that he said to these women. The media in Seattle went into hyperdrive, publicizing everything that they knew about the cases at this point, and it's from this double murder that takes place on June 14th that the cases in Washington and Oregon end up being dubbed the Ted Murders. And it shows you at this point some idea of where Ted Bundy's mindset is at. He's feeling very cocky, arrogant, that he cannot be caught and cannot be held accountable for his actions because he is much too smart for the police. So smart, in fact, that he can take a young woman within feet of her back door, and then less than a month later, take two women in broad daylight, surrounded by thousands of people, with no one raising an eyebrow or putting a stop to his actions. The police are able to get a composite sketch of the man calling himself Ted, which is all over the media, and as a result of this, police departments throughout Seattle are inundated with phone calls with people claiming to have seen the individual or who to know who that individual is. And it is very important and very interesting to note that Ted Bundy was in fact one of those Teds that was named. However, because of his clean-cut lifestyle and his ability to not arouse suspicion from those who knew him, Ted Bundy was completely able to fly under everyone's radar. So we're going to end this week's episode at this point with the end of the summer of 1974. Ted Bundy has already taken and murdered 8 young women since the start of the year, and unfortunately, there is no end in sight to the crimes that he is going to commit. Until next time, The Death Cast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!